Most people remember Bayard Rustin as the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. He was African American, he was gay, he was involved in various social movements.
There's nothing like being treated badly by the men who thought that women's place in the movement was to sleep with them and to provide peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That was a great way to make a feminist out of anyone. Although Red Stockings created the saying, the personal is political, when it came to lesbians, they thought the personal was personal and they didn't want to hear about it.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Our news wrappers gave thanks for some time off during the U.S. holiday, but they'll be back next week. In the headlines so far, marriage equality is finally coming to Finland, Slovakia sets the date, but a Mexican couple's wedding is bomb-threatened, and gay men are stoned to death by the Islamic State. On this special program, however, veteran New York lesbian feminist activist Carla Jay shares her passions with our Steve Pride. But first, Barack Obama recently awarded the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom, to the late out-organizer of the historic 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. His partner during the last 10 years of his life discussed the civil rights pioneer's legacy with This Way Out correspondent Vash Bodhi.
I have a dream.
I got a dream.
One day.
We're gonna work it out.
One day.
We're gonna work it out.
One day.
My name is Walter Nagel. I am a 62-year-old white male. I live in New York City, and my time is pretty much devoted at this point to preserving the legacy of Bayard Rustin.
Will you tell me who Bayard Rustin was?
Bayard Rustin was a significant figure in the advancement of the democratization of the United States in the 20th century. Most people remember him as the organizer of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his very famous I Have a Dream speech. Bayard was 51, 52 years old at that point in his life, and he had 25, 30 years of actively organizing prior to that. He wasn't just involved in African-American civil rights issues. He was involved in what we think of nowadays as human rights issues before that term was really in the common nomenclature. He was working in anti-colonial movements abroad over in Africa. He was over in India during the end of the British colonization of India. He was working against the proliferation of atomic weapons. So he wasn't sort of a one-issue person, but the large umbrella issue was the whole issue of making the world safer and providing rights to all people all over the world.
How did you meet Bayard?
I met Bayard in 1977 in Times Square, and at that point I was thinking of relocating to San Francisco. This was in April. And I was waiting on the corner to cross the street and go over to the store, and Bayard came along, and we were both standing there, and we just kind of looked at each other, and lightning struck. I made it to the store. I got my newspaper, but I never made it out to San Francisco. And, you know, we were sort of dating, spending a lot of time together, weekends together for the first year or so, and then I pretty much moved in with him in his apartment.
In New York City?
Yeah, right here in this apartment that we're sitting in. Yeah, this is where we lived together for the 10 years that I was with him.
Does your work now involve any sort of outreach?
I work very closely with the makers of the documentary film Brother Outsider, The Life of Bayard Rustin. We do a lot of appearances together because it's one thing to be talking to a group of people about someone, but when you have the visual and the audio images of that person that you can work with, it really gives the audience much more of a flavor and an idea of who that person actually was. The film came out in 2003, and you know, documentaries don't normally have a very long life, but there's something about Bayard's story that I think people find inspiring. And over the last 10 years, you know, during Black History Month, during Gay Pride Month, there would be showings of the film, and we would make appearances doing Q&As or being on panel discussions about it. But in the last couple of years, it's been picked up as a diversity training tool in a lot of corporations and law firms. And they will have like a diversity event and they'll show the film and they'll have a discussion. Because of Byard's many identities, his many hats, if you will, you know, he was African American, he was gay, he was involved in various social movements, it's an opportunity to bring people to the same table that might not always be there. And so it really provides an opportunity, I think, for people to have dialogue that would not normally be engaged in those kinds of discussions. So I think it opens up a lot of doors. The film's also being shown in a lot of schools. He overcame tremendous obstacles during his life to become who he was. And I think it's inspiring in that way. I mean, it's not a film about a perfect man. It's not a film about a saint. In that way, I think kids can look at it and see, this is a hero. This is somebody I could become, as opposed to looking at a film about someone else who shall remain nameless. But, you know, that person was so perfect, I could never become that person. This is somebody that had the same struggles that I have.
You know I'm going to ask you to name that person.
I think that the culture likes to create these heroes, these idols, not even heroes, idols, people that you kind of worship, you know, a lot of entertainment figures, people like that. In the latest book that came out about Byard, it's a collection of his letters. And in one of the letters, he says something to the effect that they're doing to Dr. King the same thing that they did to Gandhi. This was after King died. They're turning him into a figure of veneration, a figure to worship, as opposed to an inspirational figure. So, you know, I would say, you know, someone like Dr. King, certainly someone like Gandhi, people didn't think of these people as saints. And of course they weren't. They were very human. And I think as historians do their research and write books and things about it, these people and their human frailties come out. And I think that's all to the good. We also have a tendency to sort of deny certain things too. And if we don't think of people as human and capable of making mistakes, if you will, or making errors of judgment, if you kind of hold them to this perfect standard, then you're going to be disappointed. And one of the ways of dealing with the disappointment is just to kind of push it aside and deny that it ever happened. To a certain degree, some of that used to happen with Byard too in some quarters, but I think it's important to accept your leaders with their faults as well as their leadership abilities and their positive aspects. You have to embrace the whole person.
What are some of the things and ways or obstacles that Byard had? And I also like for you to tell me some of the ways that he is really inspirational to people.
When he first came to New York, he had a brief flirtation of affiliation with the Young Communist League. Because at that time, the Communist Party was really one of the few organizations that was dealing with the issue of racial discrimination, segregation, racial injustice. They had a committee to end discrimination in the military. And in the early days of World War II, the Communist Party was against World War II. And so they were out there agitating people to resist, you know, service, do that kind of thing. And that was consistent with Byard's own beliefs. But then when Germany invaded the Soviet Union, they just did an about-face, like overnight. And they told Byard to disband his committee to end discrimination. And he felt that, you know, this was not faithful to the reasons that he joined the League, and so he just left. Another thing was he was a draft resister, a conscientious objector during World War II. And World War II, we always think of that as the good war. It was the fight against Hitler and Nazism. And so taking that kind of a position was not very popular at the time. And of course, the third thing was the fact that he was gay. He was homosexual. And he was arrested on a morals charge in 1953 out in Pasadena, California.
Morals charge?
Well, what they used to call back then morals charge, lewd vagrancy, that kind of thing. He was discovered in the backseat of a car with two guys, like, I don't know, it was like, I think, 1 or 2 in the morning on a back street. And, you know, he was arrested and he did time in the local jail. And so when people wanted to attack the movement, if Byard was any kind of a visible presence, they would kind of go for the jugular, they would go for him, and it's, they would, you know, here's this commie pinko fag leading the civil rights movement, organizing these demonstrations. And they got away with that for quite a number of years. But Byard was someone who was very strong. He had a very strong sense of identity. He had tremendous personal courage. He was out there in the 1940s, sometimes by himself, sometimes with 3 or 4 other activists, going into the South and riding on trains and buses, going into restaurants, being arrested, and really risking their lives. I mean, they could have been lynched. And so he had a really strong sense of himself and a strong sense of standing up to evil, if you will. And so he was not discouraged or he was not defeated by these continuous attacks. Where he was disappointed in the fact that the leadership, including Dr. King, did not support him. You know, when these threats came to light, they would say, okay, well, we got to ditch Rustin for a while, or we got to send him into the shadows or whatever. But then when the 1963 march came, Strom Thurmond tried the same thing. It was about 2 weeks before the march. He got up on the Senate floor and read into the Senate record, you know, Byrd's arrest record and all of this stuff. And that was the time when the civil rights leadership, under the leadership of A. Philip Randolph, who was really the dean of the civil rights movement, that was the time when they rallied around Byrd. Mr. Randolph was kind of telling people to step into line here, if you will. It was 2 weeks before the march. The tremendous organization had gone into it. It was going to happen one way or the other. It was like a train coming down the track. There was no way to really turn it around. And so finally, the united leadership, you know, with Mr. Randolph as their spokesman, came out and made a statement on behalf of Byrd's character. And because of that, you know, it kind of eliminated the opportunities of people to do that kind of thing in the future. You know, it pulled the rug out. And I'm not going to say that people didn't try it. People did try it. But at that point, it was like, you know, all of this stuff, it's out there. It's in the national news. It's on the front page of the newspapers. So that's it. There's nothing more to be said about it. So they united around him and supported him as the deputy director of the march, and things moved forward.
So what would you say were some of Byrd's greatest accomplishments?
I guess if you had to say one thing, you know, you would say the March on Washington. And it was an accomplishment. I mean, people look at the March on Washington and they always associate it with Dr. King. You know, Dr. King gave the greatest speech on that day and possibly the greatest speech of his life. There were many other people that spoke that day. Byrd spoke or read the demands of the march that day. But what you need to think about is Washington at that time was just pretty much a southern city. It was a segregated city. There were not a lot of places where African Americans could stay, eat, do that kind of thing. I mean, people were terrified of the march. Nothing like that had ever been seen before. The Kennedy administration was lobbying and working against it. They finally had to just give in to it and cooperate with it, but they were terrified. Businesses closed down. Certainly all of the liquor stores in Washington area were closed that day, and people left the city because they were afraid. We think of the I Have a Dream speech, which was really the last speech of the day, I think. But what would have happened had violence broken out? That speech might have never been delivered. And so it was because of the masterful organization of Byrd that really gave the platform, gave the opportunity for that speech to be delivered. So I think, you know, that was truly a great accomplishment. But I think more importantly, he was largely responsible for showing Americans a way to nonviolently petition your government, whether it be your local government or the national government, to organize nonviolently, to be out there and demonstrating and to achieve goals. He'd gone over to India and studied with the heirs of Gandhi after Gandhi was assassinated. And he really learned, I think, the mechanics and the ideas behind really bringing large groups of people together. That was the main thing that he really offered to Dr. King.
I have a dream.
I got a dream.
One day.
We're gonna work it out.
One day.
That was Walter Nagel discussing his partner of 10 years, civil rights icon Byrd Rustin, with correspondent Vosh Bodhi.
Hi, this is Janice Ian, and you're listening to This Way Out. You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
Hi, I'm News Wrap reporter Carol Myers. It's that time of year again, when many of our U.S. listeners consider ways to maximize their annual charitable tax deductions.
And I'm NewsWrap reporter Wenzel Jones. No matter where you are in the world, we need your help. Log on to thiswayout.org to do your part to keep this nonprofit volunteer-based show going.
You'll also find some unique musical, cultural, and historical programming from the This Way Out archives as our way of saying thank you. And those CDs make unique holiday gifts, too.
Please go to thiswayout.org to support our efforts to inform, entertain, and educate listeners around the world. Or postal mail P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA.
From the This Way Out family to you and yours, happy holidays, and thank you.
This Way Out correspondent Steve Pride continues our LGBTs in History theme with one of the movement's leading lights.
Carla J was already a member of the feminist action group Red Stockings, as well as the early lesbian organization Daughters of Bilitis, when in 1969, in the wake of the Stonewall riots, she joined the just-forming Gay Liberation Front, GLF. We're meeting in Midtown New York City for a chat about the future and the past.
I'm Carla J. I'm the author, editor, and translator of 10 books, the most recent of which is Tales of the Lavender Menace, a Memoir of Liberation. I also edited 24 books for NYU Press for a series called The Cutting Edge, Lesbian Life and Literature. I just retired from Pace University after 39 years of teaching English, women's studies, and queer studies.
How did you become an activist?
I really became caught up in historical events. For one thing, I went to Barnard, which was part of Columbia, and I just happened to be there during the Columbia uprisings. And it was the total injustice of the New York City Tactical Police Force, which rounded up the innocent and the guilty alike, which thrust me into the movement. There's nothing like being out there on the campus and being chased around by police to see friends arrested and beaten up for doing nothing mostly, and also to be treated badly by the men who thought that women's place in the movement was to sleep with them and to provide peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That was a great way to make a feminist out of anyone. So a lot of us came out of this uprising as feminists, as pacifists. And also another important thing that happened to me when I was in college was that Malcolm X came to Barnard to speak in February. I think it was in 1964. And 2 days later, he was dead. And I met him 2 days before his assassination. And it was just such a colossal event, you know, to meet someone who was then assassinated and who was really, at that moment in his life, reaching out to, you know, white college kids like me. It was really quite phenomenal for me. And I really was very interested in the civil rights movement as well. Then I heard about the women's movement, and that feminists were forming groups, you know, Red Stockings, New York Radical Feminists. And I went to an event where different feminist groups were recruiting. And I decided to go with a radical group called Red Stockings, which had developed something called consciousness raising, which they had borrowed from the mainland Chinese, as we called them back then. And in China, it was called speaking bitterness. There were a lot of very interesting people in that group, including Rita Mae Brown, Alex K. Schulman, both of whom are well-known writers. And we analyzed things that we had never discussed before as women, things about how we were raised differently as men and women, being raised as boys and girls, and relationships and our education and how that might have been different because of our gender. Today, of course, people speak of these things, but people really had never spoken of these things. And we wrote position papers, and we also did a lot of work around abortion, which was illegal. However, the feminist movement was homophobic. It was also somewhat classist. They were middle-class white ladies. They weren't particularly interested in the civil rights movement. And they certainly weren't interested in lesbians. Although Red Stockings created the saying, the personal is political, when it came to lesbians, they thought the personal is personal and they didn't want to hear about it. So when Stonewall happened and the Gay Liberation Front formed shortly thereafter, I didn't walk over there. I ran over there to join the Gay Liberation Front. And that's how I became not just a radical feminist, I became a radical gay activist.
You know, in the 1960s, it seemed possible that anyone could change the world. How do you explain that era to millennials?
I don't think that young people today can understand what our lives were like in the 1960s. When I was at Barnard, a lesbian could be thrown out for being a lesbian. Women's colleges in particular didn't want to be known as hotbeds of lesbians. You could be arrested if there were a raid on a bar, even if you had the right ID and you were of legal age, which was of 18 at the time in New York, and you were wearing the proper clothing. if they got any information off you, if they got your name, if they got your address, and they found out your employer or your school or where you lived, you would lose your apartment, you would lose your job, your family would kick you out. You could simply lose everything. We had no rights at all. We couldn't find each other because words like homosexual or gay or lesbian, which came along with the Gay Liberation Front, could not be printed in any newspaper or in the yellow pages, which preceded the internet. It was really this time of loneliness and isolation, and many people were ashamed of each other or of themselves. It was not kind of a happy time for most gay men and lesbians to be who we were. So it's hard to understand that today. When we first met the Gay Liberation Front, there were some people, interestingly enough, who expressed the desire when we said, what do we want? Some people actually said they wanted to get married. But more people said, I would really just like to be able to hold my lover's hand and not be beaten up. You know, that seemed like a far more realistic goal. I never thought that we'd have the right to get married in my lifetime. I'm thrilled that we do. It really wasn't a primary goal. It's a complicated issue. It certainly wasn't my own first priority. We wanted to live in peace at a time when people were being persecuted. And we also have to remember that there were people in our movement who were killed for being out there and working for the movement. One of the problems of the gay movement back in 1969, and maybe today, is that we have very tenuous bonds. What is it that holds us together? We like people of the same sex. This is LG, some B people, and not all people who are I or T. And what holds us all together is that we are oppressed by some people in society at large as queer. And that's a very tenuous bond. We don't come from the same class. We don't come from the same race. We don't come from the same religious background. We don't have the same educational background. And so what held people in, for example, the Black civil rights movement together does not hold us together. And this is one reason why the Black movement could have a leader like Martin Luther King Jr., and we never had a Martin Luther Queen to lead us. When anyone has risen to the top of our movement, we have torn that person down because there's never going to be a person that represents us. And this was the problem from the very beginning. We were in there, you know, Black, white, Latinos, street transvestites, people who had sex in the back of trucks, lesbians who came in off the streets, college-educated, radical feminists like myself, gay men who had been on the Venza Ramos brigades, men who came in from Mattachine. We had nothing in common except the fact that we were really angry about what had happened at Stonewall. We wanted to do something, and we couldn't agree on much more. And we tried to hold it together. We did a lot. You know, we had a lot of actions. We created dances. We picketed the New York Times. We had other political actions as well. But the other side of it is, you know, when people say, well, why didn't these groups last? We never intended it to last. We weren't setting up a corporation that was supposed to last in perpetuity. We had no political structure. We didn't even have leaders like a president and vice president. We had a chair for a month whose name was picked out of a hat. That's how I became the head for 1 month. My name was simply picked out of a hat. We were an anarchistic sort of organization. But those same sorts of issues exist today. People need more to act on a micro front. And that's why when groups represent us nationally and they lobby for something nationally to represent us all, no one is ever going to agree with what it is they want to do. Gay men and lesbians in the military? Well, a lot of people are going to like that. And other people are going to say, we don't want to get in the military. You know, if there's ever a war and there's a draft, you have lost your get out of the military free card, you know? So we are never going to agree on anything and everything. And instead of taking activism into our own hands, we've pulled out our credit cards and we've turned over our own lives to large organizations, like, for example, the Human Rights Campaign. We have become lobbyists. And it's not that we shouldn't do that. There is some irony, however, in the fact that Edie Windsor, a single plaintiff, overturned all of these laws when I'm 100% certain that probably large organizations like Lambda Legal Defense that they were putting together these coalitions of plaintiffs that would represent different categories, let's say, of people who were discriminated against, like veterans and people who couldn't get other kinds of benefits because their marriages weren't recognized by the federal government, for example, Social Security benefits and so on. But that's what many people do. People would rather partake of social events and write out a financial reward for someone to take care of us. Now, for certain things, that makes sense. We can't do cancer research. We can't do HIV research. So, of course, give money to somebody who can do this research for you. There are things that we cannot do. However, in our local communities, there are things we can do. Just to give you one, for instance, I see a lot of activists like myself who, unlike me, didn't have this moment of enlightenment where I said to myself, aha, we never got a dime for what we did. And I said to myself, I got to get a job, you know. I never got any money for activism. I'm not complaining. I did okay. But I see a lot of people I knew from the women's movement, from the LGBTQ movement, who are really badly off. People without whom we wouldn't have marriage. We wouldn't have anything. And if you're out there and you're young, you know, and you can't go over to help an LGBTQ senior for an hour a week, help them shop, help them whatever, do something, then there's really a problem. Say thank you to these people because their being out helped us be out. The people who are older than I am, who are 80, helped me be out.
Carla, any final thoughts you want to share?
What I learned from Gandhi was until you find something you're willing to die for, you don't have something you're willing to live for. And because I inadvertently faced death literally a couple of times, and because I faced the wrath of friends and foes, and faced poverty and lived in poverty, there's nothing that frightens me. The fact that I have lost my eyesight, you're going to have to run me over with a Mack truck to stop me. You know, because I've been so lucky to be in this movement, to have had this life, to have seen these changes, to have met all the people I've met, to have gone the places I've gone, to have seen the changes I've seen. And, you know, I just feel incredibly lucky. And I think that's an amazing thing.
This has been a conversation with legendary lesbian and feminist activist Carla J. I'm Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Vosh Bodhi, Janice Ian, Carol Myers, Wenzel Jones, and Steve Pride contributed program material, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible with the invaluable support of our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org for our special year in review, along with CD subscriptions and other gift ideas, mugshots of the crew, and a lot more. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 5KIX Kangaroo Island, South Australia, WUML Lowell, Massachusetts, KMUD Garberville, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.